Welcome to Inside Voices, a well-read magazine, Between the Pages podcast. Thank you for joining us. I'm your host, Robert Gwaltney.
And I'm host, Jeffrey Dale Lofton. And we are so excited to enter into conversation today with author Christopher Swan. Before we begin today, we want to share a little bit about you, Christopher, with our listeners. So Christopher Swan is a novelist and a high school English teacher, a graduate of Woodbury Forest School in Virginia, and he earned his PhD in creative writing from Georgia State University. He's been a Townsend Prize finalist, longlisted for the Southern Book Prize, and twice been a finalist for a Georgia Author of the Year Award. And in 2022, he won that coveted award. He lives with his wife and his two sons in Atlanta, where he is the English department chair at Holy Innocents Episcopal Church, Episcopal School, excuse me. He is the author of the novels, Shadow of the Lions, Never Turn Back, A Fire in the Night, Never Go Home, and Never Back Down. So Christopher, first question, protagonists have an origin story. So what about you? What's author Christopher Swan's backstory?
Well, first, thank you all for having me on here. It's wonderful always to talk with you, Robert and Jeffrey. It's good to meet you. Let's see. The short version is that in my eighth grade social studies teacher was frog marching us through the Revolutionary War unit and assigned us a project, which he was very excited about. And most of us thought, okay, this is going to be the same thing they've done every year. We were going to do a book report in Johnny Tremaine or a poster project in How a Musket Worked. And she gave us a bunch of other options on mimeographed paper, if you remember what that was like, with the purple ink. And one of the options was to write a diary or a journal from the point of view of a fictitious person who was witnessed or participated in an actual event in the Revolutionary War. Now, looking back on it, that was kind of tricky because that meant that we were going to have to do some research into said event and so on. But I saw that and thought, I'm going to do that. My friends all said, no, do the musket poster, man. It's going to be so much easier. And I said, no, because everyone in our class, okay, so, you know, Rod Thomas was going to do, I know he's going to do the book report in Johnny Tremaine, but everybody else is going to do a musket poster. And I'm not going to, no, I'm not doing that. And that was the first complete a longish work of fiction that I wrote. And I wish I had a copy of it. I'm sure it was horrible, but it was a whole lot of fun to write. I had some backwoods, third-rate Daniel Boone type character that didn't like this taxation without representation. So he, you know, picked up his musket, which I jokingly say at that point, I knew very well how they worked because of all my friends, and went off to join the colonials who were rebelling. And my teacher praised it, and my friends said that wasn't bad, which for 13-year-old boys is very high praise. So at that point, I thought, okay, what? I like this. I like writing stories. Can you do this? Do people do this as a living? Obviously, people write books, but even then, I figured that most people didn't just, you know, write a book and go, well, now I'm done. I'll go to Hilton Head for the next couple of years, and then if I get bored, maybe I'll write another book. And it turned out a lot of them teach. The total extent of my vocational exploration was that. I thought, okay, I'm going to teach and I'll write books. And I'm still doing that now. So there's nothing very dramatic. It was a teacher giving an assignment at the right moment. And it piqued my imagination. And I realized I could do something. It's what teachers I've learned really should and most try to do with students, and it lit a fire and it's still burning. So
you mentioned that you you become a writer and you get to spend a lot of time at Hilton Head. You actually are at Hilton Head right now as we speak.
That is where I am right now. Yes. I'm on vacation with my family this week. But I don't live here, and yes, you know, one does have to pay the mortgage, and you know, if you have children, you have to help provide for them. So, but I was very fortunate that teaching, I thought it's just something I was going to do to pay the rent while I wrote the great American novel, whatever that is. And it turned out I had an affinity for teaching, and I loved it. And so I stumbled into sort of two careers that I love. The writing career took a little bit longer to get going, but once it did, it's gone well.
Well, I really enjoyed watching your writing career from your debut novel to the book that's recently come out, Never Back Down, which is book number 5 for you. Would you like to set up the book, Chris, for our listeners?
Sure. Never Back Down is the third in my Faulkner family series, although I've tried to write each one of the books so that it's a standalone, which I learned early on from some other people who've written series that I wish I'd known this when I started. So let me tell you, write them so people can kind of stumble into the series and still read the book and want to go back and read the first ones, but not be completely lost if they come in book 2 or 3. Sorry, would never turn back. Short version is Ethan Faulkner and Susanna or Susie Faulkner are siblings, and they are tragically orphaned in a violent home invasion that takes the lives of their parents, and they have to live with their only remaining living relative, their uncle Gavin in Atlanta, who turns out is more than a little bit shady. And I was interested what would happen to both of these children as they grew up, if they'd been faced with this sort of event. And Ethan has a relatively quote unquote normal life as a teacher, like his mother was before. And Susie is completely the opposite and is pretty wild and uninhibited. And she was a secondary character and never turned back. But that book was so hard to write. I was having a hard time making the story work that I spent a whole lot of time with the characters and they stuck around with me. And Susie did especially. And so I wrote another book with many of the characters, except now Susie took center stage and she's the protagonist in Never Go Home. And that story led into Never Back Down, where she is, when she grew up as a teenager, Ethan decided as he grew up, I'm not going to have any part of my uncle's criminal life and I'm going to have a normal life. And Susie, growing up as a teenager, she's 3 years younger than Ethan, said, I'm going to find the person who killed my parents and do to him what he tried to do to me. And that situation gets resolved in the first book of the series. And so Susie is left with, okay, what do I do now? I have this set of skills, which Robert, in the past, you've asked me about some of those skills. And did I have any?
Oh, right.
Do you have any? Is this autobiographical in any way? And my wife, Kathy, was upstairs listening when you were talking to me at that point and started laughing because no, that's not me. But Susie is a wonderful character to write because she's so different from me. And she does things that I can't do and probably wouldn't do, although part of me at times wishes I could. In terms of writing a wrong or something like that. And that's where she is at the beginning of Never Back Down, is trying to help a young woman out of a dangerous situation. And Susie has her own baggage that she's dragging around behind her. So it's a character-based piece of fiction, but it's also a thriller. It's the kind of thing I love to write.
Christopher, you know, Susie in the very first book doesn't seem like a secondary character to me.
When I say that, and every time I say that, I sort of cringe because she isn't a secondary character, but she's very important, but she's not the narrator. It's her brother in the first book. And I wrote that book and thought this was a standalone book. I had no plans to turn it into a series, except that, again, it took me so long to kind of get that story to work, at the backstory to fit in a way that wasn't bogging it down. I spent a whole lot of time with the characters, and Susie especially took up a lot of space in my head. And I've told the story before, but her very first scene, she's a 10-year-old girl eating cold peas at dinner, and she's going to argue with her brother Ethan. And I did that to establish the family dynamic. And in my head, Susie said, no, I'm not going to do that. And I said, yes, you are. I'm the author. I made you. You're going to do. And people who don't write books think this is a very strange thing. And I didn't hallucinate her as if she were sitting next to me. It was just in my head. The character said, no, I'm not going to eat the peas. I made her eat the peas and the scene died. By which I mean, I could write words, but they weren't any good. It was suddenly like I was walking through quicksand and I got frustrated and walked away from my laptop. When I came back later, I said, fine, you refuse to eat the peas. Because it wasn't a dramatic, it wasn't a big deal. It had nothing really to do with plot. But in my head, Susie said, thank you. And then the scene went quite well. So from that point on, whenever I'm stuck, I just think, okay, what do you want to do? And from somewhere in my brain, Susie says, oh, I'm going to do this. And most of the time, it is ridiculous and dangerous and pretty much on point for her, and it works well for the story. So yeah, she is larger than life.
You know, you talked a little, you've been talking a little bit about, you know, listening and letting the characters tell you what they want to do next. You know, but within the genre that you write, Chris, with literary and thriller, sort of a blending of those two, you're letting the characters tell you what to do next. But talk a little bit about how much of the story that you know on the front end when you begin to write. What's your process like?
My standard response to that is it's really sweet that y'all think I have a process. It's different for every book, but my first book opens up with a mystery, with a missing boy. And I didn't know what had happened to him. I figured I'll just figure it out as I write, kind of like when you're reading a mystery. And it turns out for me anyway, that's a terrible way to write a mystery, that at some point you, the author, have to know what happened. And so whenever I write a story where there is some sense of a mystery, what's going to happen next, which is tends to be most everything I write, I found that I have to, at some point pretty early on in the novel, if not the very beginning, I have to come up with, okay, some major goalposts. This has to happen, this has to happen, and this is where I want it to end up. All with the caveat that in the middle of writing, I can change it up however I want, but that gives me some kind of direction. It's like going on a road trip with a map, but also the freedom to change your direction. Go, you know what? I think I'm going to pull, let's go to St. Louis. And when we weren't going there, we're going to Chicago. Yeah, but it's on the way. We'll stop there for a little bit, see what's going on. That's sometimes how it is when I write. I don't want to plot things out too much ahead of time because I guess partly because I'm not built that way, which may be a polite way of saying I'm a little lazy in terms of that. But also I feel like if I plot it out too carefully and too neatly, then I'll leave too many breadcrumbs for a reader to go, oh, okay, I see what's going to happen. And then when it does happen, you're like, yeah. And so instead of getting that, oh, I got it. Or, okay, I didn't see that coming, but that makes sense. They're like, great, I predicted this 100 pages earlier. And now I'm bored. So I like to have, like, as I call them, goalposts to reach. And whatever happens in the middle happens while I'm writing. So it's messy, but it's a system that works for me.
No, I agree. I mean, I like the guidepost approach to writing. I think that a lot of magic can happen. I think that you set out to know just enough to be able to get you from the beginning, the middle, of the end. And for me, that's the exciting part of writing, is not knowing everything that's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm curious to know, because you know, when you come upon, when you decide what's going to happen, when it comes to you, how do you know what to hold back? How do you know when to release those crucial details or when to hold things back so that you don't give away too much and you do keep the suspense? How do you do that?
I've read a lot, and I read all kinds of stuff. I read mysteries and thrillers and suspense and literary fiction and science fiction and sometimes fantasy. But most authors use suspense one way or the other to make somebody turn the page. And it's a fine balance between you want to withhold information from a reader and make them want it. But if you hold it too far, you hold it for too long, they lose interest and don't care. If you reveal things too early or pretend there's a big secret when it's really easy to figure out, then you lose it that way. So I try to steer between those two. I jokingly call it butler or aliens. Like, oh, the butler did it? How surprising, right? I figured that out on page 50 and read the rest of the book in the vain hope that something exciting would happen. Thank you for ruining my weekend. Or it's aliens kidnapped? What? What is that? Has nothing. There's no hint of like the. It's as if the writer has thought, I don't know how to get out of this problem, so I'll just invent something. And I think we've all read mysteries that fail in one of those two ways. And so I just try to keep that in mind when I'm writing, and I think about how movies are a very different medium, but I think about how movies withhold information and then give them to you, because you can do a lot with a book that you can't do in a film. But in terms of withholding information and revealing information in dramatic ways, films can be a powerful guide to that as well. And so I don't try to copy other works of fiction or films, but I try to think of, okay, how did they do it in this? How can I do it? And then I have my wife, Kathy, reads almost everything that I write, and she often will give me pointers. She's my first editor, and she's very good, and she's very honest, and will let me know, you know, that, yeah, you've gone down a rabbit hole here. No one's going to care. Or this is getting too slow, or that was a really good scene. So I think it's a matter of paying attention to what other writers have done and having a good sense of how a story sort of unfolds, because readers like to feel a story kind of be revealed to them, and they can figure parts of it out. But the best kind of feeling, if you have any kind of mystery, is, as I said earlier, oh, I didn't see that coming, but that makes perfect sense. Like, you got me, but okay, you gave me the clues and I didn't figure it out, but it was fair. All right, good on you, author. As opposed to, again, aliens did it. That just seems like a cheat. So I want to, hopefully I steer between the sort of butler and aliens problems. So,
you know, one of the things that I think, you know, with modern audiences, both readers and theater goers, it's individuals are really good at figuring out what's going to happen mm-hmm. at the end. So when you're writing thrillers, to be able to toss those red herrings out and to be able to send readers down paths that don't end up to where they think they're going to go by the end of the novel is very challenging, I'm thinking, this day and age. Do you find that you have that sense of responsibility to really ensure that you're giving your reader a roller coaster ride of a story?
I want readers to, as I said, keep turning the page, and I don't, but the main thing for me in writing these books is with the characters themselves, like Susie Faulkner, for instance, who is near and dear to my heart and is, again, very different from me in many ways, which makes her a lot of fun to write. But the longer I've done this, the more strongly I believe that if you write a story with a character that a reader can connect with in some way, they don't have to like the character. I'll use Hannibal Lecter as an example. Nobody likes Hannibal Lecter. Nobody wants to hang out with Hannibal Lecter, but we're fascinated and terrified and yet also fascinated with the man. And so we'll read The Silence of the Lambs or watch the film version and figure out, okay, who is this guy and what is he doing and how, and oh my God. So if you can create characters that you get readers to follow, you can write any kind of story you want. So this is kind of a roundabout way, Robert, I'm sorry, I've answered your question, no. But I think if you can create a character that people will follow, then you have a lot of leeway. I don't want to write characters who are just cardboard cutouts or cliches. I try not to. But yeah, after I do that, then yes, I don't want, there's only so many plots in the world, and there are only so many things you can do. But I think it's important to give readers a reason to keep turning those pages with the kind of books that I'm writing, to find, maybe figure out what's going to happen. But again, try to keep them from figuring out everything or seeing, okay, what is this character going to do next? And again, I teach high school fiction. I teach a lot of British literature. You know, Hamlet is a whole story of, okay, is the prince going to get off his duff and avenge his father and kill his uncle? Or is he just going to act crazy the whole play? Is Jane Eyre going to choose Mr. Rochester or St. John Rivers, or just say, I don't need a man, and ride off into this? Like, what's going to happen next? And I think that is the responsibility of all writers who are trying to tell a narrative, is to get people to care about, okay, what's going to happen next. It doesn't have to be a thriller in any way, but that just happens to be the genre I like to play in.
Christopher, some writers write for a particular person. I remember reading, and I think it's On Writing, Stephen King writes for his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Do you write for anyone in particular, and does that have an influence on, you know, how you craft a story?
No, it's a strange, I remember talking about this, and I'm a product of creative writing programs, and I remember talking about that in workshop. Our teacher said, who are you writing for? And most of us in the workshop, this is in graduate school, most of us had done this a few times. And I remember saying, I kind of said, you all. And everybody kind of nodded and said, yes. And she said, and I didn't mean that in terms of a grade, but I thought, this is my audience. These are people who, you know, they care, and they give me more or less pretty honest feedback about what I'm doing. And our teacher was sort of surprised by that. And because she often thought about, like you said, and I use Stephen King's On Writing. I use that with my creative writing class in high school. And, you know, he writes for his wife, Tabitha. And I don't write for my wife particularly, but I do find myself thinking, okay, when Kathy reads this, is she going to say, you've gone down another rabbit hole? Or you've gone Mission Impossible, which is her terminology for if I've done something really kind of ridiculous, where she usually has I'm like, I don't really know how to get these two characters together. I mean, I could use an email. Or maybe she said, have them call. And I'll just stare at her, because I've made it far more complicated than I needed to. And I'll just turn around and walk down the hall and go sit down and go, fine, just a phone call. And I'll write. And of course, that's the simplest answer, and it's the best one. So I will think of her in those times. I don't have a particular person, but I have to remind myself that readers are, they're smart, that, and I mean, but they fill in, I'm giving them half the story. The other half is sort of in their imagination. They're having to recreate it in their heads. So I have to do it as clearly as possible. But I have to remind myself that the reader can, I don't have to explain every single thing to the reader. I have to find that balance. So I think about that. I think of somebody saying, I don't need all this information. I just need a simple answer. And sometimes I do need to have a lot of information given. It's just a matter of thinking of a sort of vague somebody who is reading the books and following them and who wants to know, again, what happens next. And I've been lucky enough, with social media being what it is, connecting with readers who have reached out and said, you know, they really enjoyed a certain story. Or sometimes I met a woman once who told me, said, you got this, I love the story, but you got this detail about the driving wrong. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she was explaining how you couldn't go this way in a certain highway. And I was pretty adamant that you could. And later on, I went back and looked at it and found out that I was right and she'd been mistaken, but which felt gratifying and also really kind of petty.
But it's fiction. Anything's possible. So.
True. I know. I was like, it's made up, man. But, you know, that's the part that you found. This is the part of the story that you found unbelievable. But yeah, I think just trying to, somebody who cares, somebody who doesn't need everything explained to them, that they're smart enough to kind of picture the rest of it themselves, but without, I can't go the other way and be too obscure. And that's where other readers come in. That's where my wife comes in and says, yeah, you need a little bit more here. You don't need that there.
So we are at the end of our time together on Inside Voices, Chris. So Never Back Down is the last book of your Faulkner family series. Last question for you. What are you going to miss most about that series?
It's possible that in the future I could write another one. But for right now, yeah, I think it's had an arc. I seem to have arrived at a good place to step off for a while, but I'm going to miss the characters a lot. I'm a high school English teacher. I cry at sunsets and supermarket openings. So this won't be surprising. I mean, I cried a little bit at writing the end of this, not because I felt, because some characters died. But also I thought, am I going to be able to see these people again, which is a strange thing to say as a writer, because yeah, I invented them, but I don't know if y'all felt this way in writing, you know, when you finish your own book and you're like, whether it's going to be part of a series or not. Okay. I know these characters are on the page and they will forever be there, but I kind of liked inventing the worlds that they are in and what they're doing. So I will miss this strange, somewhat dysfunctional family that's both family by blood and also by choice in these books that also still manage to have each other's backs. I'm gonna miss them.
Well, it has been a pleasure spending time with you, Chris. We wish you every success with Never Back Down, and we look forward to your next book and when we can have you back.
Well, thank you so very much, y'all. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to watching more episodes with you guys. And y'all go out and get a copy of Never Back Down.
Absolutely. So, gentle listeners, until next time, I'm host Robert Gluttony.
And remember, to be creative is to be courageous. And I'm Jeffrey Dale Lofton.